Okay, we're back for episode 75, if I do my math correct. 75,
yes.
Powers and Principalities. I think tonight we agreed to talk about the ADL and B'nai B'rith. It used to be ADL of B'nai B'rith. The ADL and B'nai B'rith, this outfit, this organization, this human rights organization. Well, I guess we can... I'll quickly refer to all things Wikipedia again about the ADL and B'nai B'rith, or B'nai B'rith. Let's see. The Anti-Defamation League, formerly known as the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, is an international Jewish non-governmental organization based in the United States. The ADL states that it fights anti-Semitism and all forms of bigotry, defends democratic ideals, protects civil rights for all, doing so through information, education, legislation, and advocacy. Founded in late September 1913 by the Independent Order of B'nai B'rith, a Jewish service organization in the United States, its original mission, a statement, was to stop, by appeals to reason, conscience, and if necessary, by appeals to law, the defamation of the Jewish people. Its ultimate purpose is to secure justice and fair treatment of all citizens alike, put an end to unjust, unfair discrimination against and ridicule of any sect or body of citizens. ADL has 29 offices in the United States and 3 offices in other countries, with its headquarters located in New York City. It was established in 1913 with its stated mission of to stop, by appeals to reason, conscience, and if necessary, appeals to law, the defamation of the Jewish people. Its ultimate purpose is to secure justice and fair treatment for all citizens alike, and to put an end forever to the unjust, unfair discrimination against and the ridicule of any sect or body of citizens. I guess I repeated myself there. But anyway, the Anti-Defamation League was founded by B'nai B'rith, of course, as a response to attacks on the Jews. The Leo Frank affair, which I think we'll talk about in more detail later, was mentioned by Adolf Krauss when he announced the creation of the ADL. Of course, its current mission now is, main mission is tracking extremists. The ADL keeps up on the activities of various extremist groups and movements, according to the ADL director, Abe Foxman. Our mission is to monitor and expose those who are anti-Jewish, racist, anti-democratic, violence-prone, and we monitor them primarily by reading publications and attending public meetings. From what I understand, they've been engaged in illegal surveillance as well. Well, because extremist organizations are highly secretive, sometimes ADL can learn of their activities only by using undercover sources who function in a manner directly analogous to investigative journalists. The ADL regularly releases reports on anti-Semitism and extremist activities on both far left and far right. For instance, as a part of its law enforcement agency resource network, the ADL has published information about the militia movement in America and a guide for law enforcement officials titled Officer Safety and Extremists. An archive of the militia watchdog research on U.S. right-wing extremism, including groups not specifically cited as anti-Semitic from 1995 to 2000, is also available on the ADL website. In the 1990s, some of the details of the ADL's monitoring activities became public and controversial, including the fact the ADL had gathered information about some non-extremist groups. I guess, I don't know who decides what's extremist and what's non-extremist. In 2013, Jan Berger, a former non-resident fellow of the Brookings Institute, wrote that the media organization should be more cautious when citing the Southern Poverty Law Center and ADL, arguing that they are not objective purveyors of data. Of course, the ADL also promotes Holocaust awareness. The ADL holds that it is important to remember the Holocaust in order to prevent such an event from reoccurring, along with sponsoring events and fighting Holocaust deniers and revisionists. The ADL has been active in urging action to stop modern-day ethnic cleansing and genocide in places like Bosnia, Darfur, and Sudan. Of course, they don't bother with Gaza, I suppose. By fighting deniers, the Anti-Defamation League defames deniers and revisionists. So a little irony there, I suppose. So that's the mission of the ADL. Of course, in the history of the ADL, there was an interesting criticism of ADL by Max Arax, a former Los Angeles Times writer and current Salon writer, of Armenian descent. He strongly criticized the role of the ADL in American Armenian genocide denial. In 2007, he spoke with Abraham Foxman, who said, "Our focus is Israel. If helping Turkey helps Israel, then that's what we're in the business of doing. What is genocide? It was wartime. Things get messy. The Turks and Armenians need to revisit their past. The Jewish community shouldn't be the arbiter of that history, and I don't think U.S. Congress should be the arbiter either." Arax later wrote on this, "I almost had to revisit the website to make sure that the ADL was still in the business of fighting not only anti-Semitism, but bigotry and extremism, and securing justice and fair treatment to all." When Arax pointed out that the genocide had been documented as a fact by many prominent historians, and that Congress recognizes all sorts of people's histories, including resolutions commemorating the victims of the Holocaust, Foxman replied, "You're not suggesting that the Armenian genocide is the same as the Holocaust, are you?" Then there's B'nai B'rith, the institution that gave birth to ADL. B'nai B'rith International is the oldest Jewish service organization in the world. B'nai B'rith states that it's committed to security and continuity of the Jewish people and the state of Israel in combating anti-Semitism and bigotry. Its mission is to promote persons of the Jewish faith and enhance Jewish identity through strengthening Jewish family life. To provide broad-based services for the benefit of senior citizens and to facilitate advocacy and action on behalf of Jews throughout the world. B'nai B'rith was founded by Aaron Schinsheimer. The B'nai B'rith was founded in Aaron Schinsheimer's Cafe in New York City, Lower East Side, on October 13, 1843, by 12 recent German Jewish immigrants led by Henry Jones. The new organization represented an attempt to organize the Jews of the local community to confront what Isaac Rosenberg and one of the founders called the deplorable conditions of Jews in this, our newly adopted country. With their Yiddish language, the founders originally named their organization Sonai des Bundes, Sons of the Covenant, to reflect their goal of a fraternal order that would provide comfort to the entire spectrum of Jewish Americans. Although early meetings were conducted in Yiddish, after a short time, English emerged as a language of choice and the name was changed to B'nai B'rith. In the late 20th century, the translation was changed to the more contemporary and inclusive Children of the Covenant. The organization's activities during the 19th and 20th centuries were dominated by mutual aid and social service and philanthropy. In 1875, a lodge was established in Toronto, followed soon after by another in Montreal, and in 1882 by a lodge in Berlin. Membership outside the United States grew rapidly. Soon, lodges were formed in Cairo, Jerusalem, 9 years before Theodor Herzl convened the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland. The Jerusalem Lodge became the first organization to hold all meetings in Hebrew. After 1881, with mass immigration of Eastern European Jews to the United States, B'nai B'rith sponsored Americanization classes, trade schools, and relief programs. This began the period of rapid membership growth as a change in the system of representation and the questioning of the secret rituals common to fraternal organizations. In response to the Kishinev pogrom in 1903, President Theodore Roosevelt and Secretary of State John Hay met with B'nai B'rith Executive Committee in Washington, D.C. B'nai B'rith President Simon Wolfe presented the draft of a petition to be sent to the Russian government protesting the lack of opposition to the massacre. Roosevelt readily agreed to transmit it, and B'nai B'rith lodges began gathering signatures around the country. So that's kind of the origins of B'nai B'rith and its history up into the 20th century. So it's a fraternal organization dedicated to promoting Jewish interest and Jewish welfare and generally justice throughout the world. So, Joe, that's kind of the received history of these two organizations. What do you have to say?
Well, you know, Wikipedia is actually pretty useful.
Yes.
because it gives exactly the structure of propaganda that each concept uses for mind control. I mean, it's become that basically. There are, you know, facts and stuff. I use it a lot.
Yeah.
But when you also have to remember that there is this really powerful control over it. But the good news is that once you recognize what it is, it's actually handy. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, what you described there was basically the exact propaganda message that B'nai B'rith and the ADL put out about themselves. You did mention Foxman's famous, kind of not seeing the Armenian genocide as having any even like remote relationship to the Holocaust. So you then, you know, that kind of breaks down the idea that the ADL and its, you know, the B'nai B'rith is actually any kind of general humane sort of organization. I mean, honestly, after I looked at it quite a bit this week, and I would say that in general, it's just complete, basically global mind control. I mean, the ADL is really in no other business. I mean, what it really does is influence the press, statements that come in the media, and it analyzes them to see if anything that could possibly basically create a kind of a resistance to the New World Order is comes about, that they can basically crush it. And so, you know, you look at the history of the ADL, it comes from Freemasonry. And, you know, so we've been so often talking about this strange relationship between Freemasons and Jews, right? To me, it's like the premier question, you know, that we have to answer right now. It's like, what is the relationship? And this is another sort of curious example of this relationship. For some reason, the individuals who created B'nai B'rith basically structured a Jewish Freemason lodge. You know, it's a secret society. No one who isn't inside B'nai B'rith can really say with any certainty what goes on inside it, but it certainly was structured as a component of Freemasonry and referred to itself as such, and had lodges and the Freemason regalia and whatnot for the first 50, 60 years of its organization, of its existence. And then at a certain point, the ADL spun off of it. And so, you know, the ADL is just basically I think if you want to understand what, like, well, what is the structure between B'nai B'rith and the ADL? I think it's sort of like the structure that we saw, as the Nazi Party was developed. You know, they would have different organizations and different names. You know, you'd have the Proto Freemasons, and then you'd have the Quattro Coronati, and then you'd have the Theosophical Society, and then you would have the Tool Society, and then finally the Nazi Party. But you could see that there was this, you know, it was just basically renaming itself to fool people. And the ADL, I think, is the same thing. It's just a way to not have people realize that, that this is somehow an aspect of Freemasonry. And then just, to sort of conclude the relationship, one thing that I was amazed at, I guess it wasn't amazed, but I mean, I thought it was very interesting, was that, when Prescott Bush was first identified as basically having so-called Nazi ties. Now, what in fact they're talking about is his relationship to Brown Brothers Harriman and the funding of the Nazi Party in the 20s and 30s, right? And so when they say, Nazi ties, they're really just talking about that he was one of the premier members of the, banking service company that funded money there. And there was suddenly this hue and cry about him because, particularly as like George W. Bush sort of becoming, a candidate for president, there are people that were using this against him. And at that point, the ADL stepped out, and they actually were the group that put an end to it. They made statements which said that that rumors about alleged Nazi ties of the late Prescott Bush had circulated widely. These charges are untenable and politically motivated. And then goes on to point out what a great person Prescott was. So you can see how selective and strategic, their so-called you know, altruistic endeavors are. But the other thing that I was aware of, but the extent of it was even surprising to me, was just how they're everywhere. It isn't just, the newspaper, the print world, the TV, criticism, of course, they don't really need to too much, but of Hollywood movies, they can make sure that politicians basically kowtow to Israel, and also to make sure that any statements about Israel are kind of have to go through a kind of a lens that they're in charge of. And so they are basically kind of a world intellectual dominating structure. You know, that's really how I would characterize it. How would you describe it, Tim? What is the ADL?
Oh, well, it's I just think it's a secret society masquerading as a human rights organization. that's a fair word. I think I've read that somewhere. I think that's probably a pretty good characterization of it, accurate, what it really does. It hides, and anything that they happen to disagree with, they call hate and bigotry, and then they try to suppress it, and they defame anybody who criticizes them or anything, aspect of Jewish power. Good example, they'll give Prescott Bush a pass for his business dealings with the Third Reich, but they're called Pappy Cannon a Nazi, more or less, right?
Sure.
In so many words. So, there's no real principle involved here at stake. It's part of the power structure, and obviously it's been used, the ADL of B'nai B'rith, now just ADL, now it's kind of used as sort of as a private intelligence operation that's going out there and imposing censorship in the media and in the internet and these things. And I myself, I did a interview with two gentlemen regarding the ADL and B'nai B'rith and its role in various assassinations and creating of false flag events. And also its role in fomenting the American Civil War. And the name ADL B'nai B'rith was in the title, and it was immediately censored on YouTube, meaning it was restricted for having offensive views in it. And it was a very sober, long 2.5 hour conversation about some of these things that the ADL had been caught up with. Now they're working. I mentioned in the introduction how it sort of kind of benignly mentions that it works with police and training. So they're the ones training our police, these ADL, which is more or less an agent of Israel, are now involved in training various police forces, particularly the command structure of the police. And they're working with Google and the various tech giants, YouTube, various other sites, other platforms that they're gonna shut down any voices that they find not congenial to their agenda. So they're guilty. They're guilty of the most crass, most obvious forms of censorship out there now, and it's become so obvious now that it's almost laughable.
It's interesting that the internet control and the way that this is all coming under the domination of the ADL. It was interesting to me to learn that the first internet basically access block was developed by the ADL. it was called Hate Filter, and it was a software program designed to block access to websites and news groups that denigrate individual on the basis of what the ADL calls immutable characteristics such as race, religion, and sexual orientation.
Sexual orientation, I love that. Yeah.
And so it says, we are engaged in a full-blown battle against high-tech hate, said ADL National Chairman Howard Berkowitz in a statement. Mm-hmm. Bigots are seducing our children with online messages presented in full color animation with music and video. This was in 1998. And I really had to laugh when I heard Berkowitz's statement. He talks about bigots seducing our children with online messages. And so they had developed hate filter. And I thought, hey, wait a second, Howard, how are you guys working with pornography? You know, I mean, any luck there? Because so I think that when you look at, you know, at this thing, hate filter, back, you know, 20 years ago, you can see that now it's disappeared. When you think of Jewish owned companies like Google, right? Think of how, you know, how sophisticated the technology would be over a 20-year development period, if this is what they've done, which I presume is the case. So now you have, you know, hate filter, you know, plus, which is basically the, you know, ways to look at the entire web and, you know, kind of smart technology that can make some grammatical understanding of words. And so they can just keep tabs on everyone who's, you know, everyone's sort of activity. And it's obviously hypocritical. It's obviously racist, or certainly it's focused in something that is, you know, to the in within the narrow racial focus of ADL, because they don't say anything about battling pornography, right?
No, that's not you can broadcast that, you can send it over the internet.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
you could print it, you can send it out and disperse it and have it proliferate in the community, but that's freedom. That's the First Amendment, Joe.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. But if you question, you know, the
talk about the USS Liberty,
right?
The King David Hotel bombing, or yeah. You know,
well, yeah. Let me give you an example of what isn't permitted within the ADL's thought world. In 1996, this was 2 years before Hate Filter, there was the event with Marlon Brando, where he was basically forced to express his remorse publicly with a rabbi, Marvin Heer, you know, and he went to the Simon Wiesenthal Center for a press conference. Anyway, do you recall what he said? What was the mortal sin that he was, you know, the ADL got him on? What Brando said was, Hollywood is run by Jews. It is owned by Jews, and they should have a greater sensitivity about the issue of people who are suffering.
That is hate-filled.
And then, of course, and this is a quote. It goes, so, you know, Brando just went total hair shirt and was just, you know, pillared back and forth. And then Abe Foxman, the ADL's director, stepped in. He goes, I think Marlon's doing a good thing, but I'm not sure it goes far enough. He's not a kid going to a museum. He's an adult who's had these views for 25 years. If he really has remorse, he ought to go on. He ought to go see his friend Larry King and tell everyone on the air. So, I mean, just to, you know, I wanted to repeat this because I think, you know, people can gauge for themselves, you know, what kind of the actual agenda and back of this force. Brando said, Hollywood is run by Jews. It is owned by Jews, and they should have a greater sensitivity about the issue of people who are suffering. Right. So I would say this is, you know, how to understand ADL is that it is really there, obviously, to keep people from understanding the truth. I mean, what else can I say about it? It just wants to make sure that there is no questioning of this incredible power that has as a centrifugal energy Jewish ethnicity and Jewish religion. You know, because I always want to, you know, make sure that people understand this isn't, you know, an accusation against a Jewish race or a Jewish religion. It's the fact is, it's like the best, you know, parallel would be if the mafia were, in fact, as the ADL has got us to believe, run by Sicilians, that would be the, you know, the group that I think is has so much power, is that they would have ethnic relationships among themselves, but they wouldn't have like a worldview that they would share with everybody, and you know, who's a Jewish ethnic or a Jewish religious.
A good example of that is when they passed the anti-organized crime law back in the late '60s, early '70s, the Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organization Act. They called it RICO for a reason. It's an Italian name.
Yeah, RICO. Exactly. Yeah.
The misdirection, given the history of Mo Dalitz, Meyer Lansky, Siegel, Las Vegas, and the Jewish Mafia. But they call it, they didn't come up with some acronym, you know, come up with a common Jewish name. You know, they pass these laws like the Patriot Act or something, always come with some awkward name so they can get some cute acronym that makes it, you know, makes the point. But Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organization Act, you know, RICO, because we all know that the organized crime, it was the Italians that were running everything, Sicilians and Italians, you know.
The ADL actually had a position called the Law Enforcement Liaison. And she was worked for the ADL to get politicians to be funded to take trips to Israel where they could meet with Israeli cultural ministers and whatnot. But also it was part of how the Israelis ended up helping to train our police forces. Mm-hmm. And the person who had this was Mary Boland, Jewish lady. Her full name was Myra Lansky Boland.
Any relation?
She was the granddaughter of Meyer Lansky. So that was a little troubling. And then,
so the,
you know,
granddaughter of the chairman of the board of Murder Incorporated.
Right. And, you know, it's like,
well, the sins of the father shouldn't be passed on.
But then the another like kind of, you get to see the hypocrisy is that, remember going back to my little curiosity about hate filter and its inability to deal with pornography. Well, that actually is quite logical because one of the people who has been most honored by the ADL and actually received what's called the Torch of Freedom Award was Hugh Hefner.
Torch, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, they gave, because, you know, he's leading us to the Torch of Freedom, right? So he actually, he was very touted by the ADL. And then the thing I thought was also quite amusing is that one of the largest contributors, you know, because they actually at one point were posting, I can't find recent data on this. I don't know what they've done, if they changed the corporate structure of it so you can't see it anymore. But in the 80s, you could actually see where the money was coming from to some extent. And the biggest contributor was Larry Flint.
So pornographers, yeah.
Yeah, so you can see, like, you know, hate filter probably.
Goy frontman for the pornography industry. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there, just to go back to the mob connection. You know, you had the national commissioner of the ADL was Theodore Silbert, who actually was the front man and associate for Meyer Lansky.
Yeah, he ran the Sterling Bank, right?
Exactly right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So you can see that you've got, and then of course Mo Dalitz, right?
Well, yeah, Mo Dalitz was the
he was the mob guy who ran Vegas, another financial partner with Meyer Lansky. He was also a Torch of Freedom. Isn't that something? And so, you know, when you look at the basically the connections, what you're really looking at is pornography, organized crime. But if it was just that, I don't think it would really be particularly destructive. I think people could see through it pretty easily. I mean, the thing that really is the power of ADL is its ability to influence statements in the media.
Yeah, the media control, yeah.
Yeah, the media control. And you don't see that, and it's all done behind the scenes. But man, oh man, they are just everywhere. Boy, this is really a problem for...
Well, it's, you know, someone like a Marlon Brando or Mel Gibson will acknowledge reality of Jewish power. And for that acknowledgement, Jewish power crushes them.
And, yeah.
But doesn't that vindicate when they have to, you know... come and prostrate themselves and and apologize. Aren't they isn't that proving their point?
Yeah. Well, I have always thought that Mel Gibson is a crypto. I think he's a lifetime actor. I've never bought his story. I know he's supposedly the son of like a fundamental Christian guy, but I just see him 100% as Freemasonry. And if you look at like the subtext Freemason imagery in his films, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I thought that, you know, his drunken rambling in Malibu, that's just another kind of mind control technique where, you know, he goes to an extreme position when he's drunk, right? So that this position can be ridiculed.
Yeah, you know, that's the standard practice. Yeah, you highlight the extreme position. Yeah, yeah. So
I mean, if you look at Gibson's background, he's got basically Jews everywhere around him. At the time of the event, I think his girlfriend was Jewish, and then he after Apocalypto, which, I mean, again, that's a movie about a new world order. I mean, it's the symbolism, in my opinion, is not particularly difficult to see. This is a Freemason vision. But anyway, he said after that, he said he was going to do a film on Judas Maccabee, right? So that he could basically, you know, talk about the creation of Eretz Israel in film. So, I mean, you know, some people said, well, he was just trying to make up for the, you know, this anti-Semitic slur. But, you know, I'm not buying it. I think it's that he's much more likely a crypto. He's like Lyndon Baines Johnson. And I would like to apply the, some kind of Gentile litmus test. But I think Gibson would fail just out of the box because I think if you look at some of the symbolism in like the Mad Max stuff, there's just Freemasonry all over the place. And so I think he's definitely inside the club. But anyway, so he was an example of, you know, an arranged event, you know, something that the ADL then can, you know, leap up and yes. say, look, there it is, you know, anti-Semitism. And you know, Tim, what struck me, because it's sort of like past a certain point of research, there's really no reason to go any further. You know, it's just everywhere. You know, there's nothing really you need to discover. The thing that I was like kind of wondering is, I had this strange question come to mind, is that one group that must really be mind controlled are Jews. Because I was thinking about this, about, you know, the people that are most prone to buy this propaganda would be basically Jews who are, you know, they would have this visceral relationship to Holocaust propaganda.
Yeah.
They would be just hair trigger, you know, because the anti-Semitic energy has been just coded into them so intensely. And then there's another thing, another problem. And that is the Bible, the Old Testament, the Torah, because there you get to see the chosen people stuff. So when you combine the ADL propaganda with the Hollywood Jewish propaganda, with the false historical narrative, whereby, you know, you get this crazy Holocaust story, with the shrunken heads and Yun Cameron and this whole stuff is being given to young people. And then you combine that with some rabbi who's talking about, you know, God gave us this chosen person status. Well, what do you think this mind of this person is going to be, you know? So the ADL is basically creating a kind of robot warrior class of Jews, right? I mean, by warrior class, maybe a bit, you know, broad. But they're people whose worldview and temperament will never be able to basically look objectively at the power and the moral behavior of their people, right? They will always have this filter, this ADL type filter that will basically they'll be like a Foxman with the the Armenian genocide. Mm-hmm. There is just nothing. Once you get, what troubles me is that you can see that even now in Gentiles to some extent, that they will unless they, you know, basically open themselves up to independent research in the internet, that they'll have a hard time not succumbing to this and not seeing themselves as basically worthy of destruction because of the horror of anti-Semitism, because the horror of the Holocaust, because and then on the other side, they promote all these good things, you know, like it's like in the Wikipedia description of the ADL, it sounds like it's some kind of, you know, charity organization, right?
Yeah, tolerance and justice, right, and freedom for all, yeah.
And so with all of those forces operating on young people, you know, as they're growing up, I mean, man, oh man, you're really having a bifurcation, a kind of a intellectual slavery that's being created with all of the propaganda.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that's interesting, if you look at the ADL of B'nai B'rith, ADL, I think it was originally called the Propaganda Committee of B'nai B'rith.
Yeah.
And it started around the early 1913. And one impetus for it was there was a police chief, Bingaman in New York, was cracking down on organized crime. And he was cracking down on Jewish organized crime, which is becoming a big problem. And of course, the complaints were coming from people within the community about these, mobsters that were shaking them down. So Italians were complaining about Italian mobsters, and some Jews were complaining about Jewish mobsters and these things. So there's a crackdown on these gangsters. And when he started to crack down on the Jewish gangsters, it was the ADL that came out and said that this is anti-Semitic, which is an old thing, because now we get the same thing later on. Alan Dershowitz in the 1980s was claiming that the case against Michael Milken was anti-Semitic, because he was Jewish. Now, you also have, of course, 1913, you had the Leo Frank trial, when he was tried and convicted for the murder of one Mary Fagan, the rape and murder of Mary Fagan. And the ADL was created specifically for that case. And Jewish Freemasonry pretty much closed the... circled the wagons on behalf of Leo Frank, and nevertheless he was convicted. And the irony is you have a case down there where they went in, they tried to railroad a couple black men for their crime to get them off the case. $25 million, or the amount that was equivalent today for $25 million, was spent to try to get him acquitted, then tried to get him off, and of course then he was. The lame duck governor down there commuted his sentence. People think he was bribed to do that, and then people were so outraged that Leo Frank was then a mob formed, and they pulled him out of prison and strung him up, I think, just outside Mary Fagan's house as a message. And this, of course, this is how the importance of the media is. This has been portrayed in the mainstream media as an anti-Semitic lynching in the South, and that's how backward and racist and anti-Semitic the South is. And racism and anti-Semitism were kind of thrown together. But it turns out that prior to this, there was no really anti-Semitism in the South. In fact, it was very philo-Semitic, and this was all, I guess, an example of propaganda in the media. And of course, at the time, a big advertising executive, a Jewish guy, got involved in this, and he also got the newspapers like the New York Times involved in this. So this is the Jewish power flexing its muscle within the media to change the narrative of this thing, the perception of it. And this was the beginning of the war on the South by organized Jewry in the United States. And this is why they started, you know, supporting civil rights in these things. And in the South, to sort of carry out a regime change in the South. Again, exploiting real grievances and problems, but for the purpose of subversion. But the irony is that the case the absurdity of the case made on behalf of Leo Frank, they're trying to say the South was really racist against blacks, and so you had this black guy who raped and murdered this white girl, but they were so anti-Semitic they decided to let the black guy go and try to lynch the Jewish guy.
Yeah,
the white guy. And No. But that was this Leo Frank case, which pretty much was the genesis for the ADL. And the ADL in the 1930s and 40s targeted people who were critical of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's attempt to get America into the Second World War that was raging. And they were instrumental in working with the FBI to go and harass members of the American First Committee. And it was, of course, it was the FBI in 1941-42, which raided the offices of the American First Committee and stole the members list, membership list of some 900,000 names, and more or less shut it down. But it was ADL urging that did that. And I remember at the time, there were some FBI agents. The FBI always attracted Catholics for some reason. It was sort of how they brought Catholics into the empire. But one Catholic FBI guy reported back to Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover at the time, and said that these people aren't German agents. They're just critical of the Roosevelt administration. You have no business harassing them. He naively thought that, you know, that would stop the harassment. But of course, they were harassed because they were opposing the policies of the Philo-Semitic Roosevelt administration, who's also doing the bidding of the British Empire to get America into yet another world war. Well, that's interesting. And notice you mentioned hypocrisy. It turns out in the 1960s that much of the surveillance and the information and dirt that was dug up on Martin Luther King was fed to the FBI by the ADL. At the same time, you have Jewish organizations that are promoting Martin Luther King. See how they're playing a double game here?
Yeah.
You know, and so the hypocrisy is there for all to see. But now it turns out the FBI, the illegal surveillance was being provided to the FBI. It turns out this still goes on in the United States today, where the FBI, the ADL is involved in all types of illegal surveillance and these things. And then they provide the information. I guess they work with the government agencies like the FBI. Same thing with the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yeah. Yeah, well, of course. And going back before the Leo Frank.
Well, by the way, Leo Frank was the head of the local chapter of B'nai B'rith in Atlanta.
That's right.
That's why the big Jew, he was a big Jew. And so the big Jews supported each other. That's another point is that Freemasonry, it's big Jews, it's powerful Jews who are perfectly willing to play mind control, dupe the little Jews, and even sacrifice them for things like Zionism, you know, like stirring up world wars.
Yeah. One thing I found was interesting was basically the ADL's response to Henry Ford, where when Ford became concerned about world Jewry, and he bought a newspaper and, you know, and then started to make statements. And I thought it was interesting, you know, Ford's position on sort of the Jewish problem in the world, and also the ADL's response to what Ford was attempting to convey. And so, if you don't mind, it's not too long, but I wanted to read Ford's statement because it's very interesting in terms of basically how the history of the world unfolded, and also the idea of would such analysis, the kind of analysis that Ford is calling for, even be thought of today? How would it be characterized? Ford wrote this in 1920, and he wrote that the Jew is again being singled out for critical attention throughout the world. His emergence in the financial, political, and social spheres have been so complete and spectacular since the war, World War I, that his place, power, and purpose in the world are being given a new scrutiny, much of it unfriendly. Persecution is not a new experience to the Jew, but intensive scrutiny of his nature and supernationality is. In other words, the relationship that Jews have, which is basically like a club that transcends nationality and gives them a kind of an international advantage.
Dual citizenship,
The Jew, he has suffered for more than 2,000 years from what may be called instinctive anti-Semitism of the other races. But this antagonism has never been intelligent, nor has it been able to make itself intelligible. Nowadays, however, the Jew is being placed, as it were, under the microscope of economic observation for the reason of his power. The reasons for his separateness, the reasons for his suffering may be defined and understood. And now this is good. It gets kind of interesting. He says, in Russia, the Jew is charged with being the source of Bolshevism, an accusation which is serious, or not, according to the circle in which it is made. We in America, hearing the fervent eloquence and perceiving the prophetic ardor of young Jewish apostles of social industrial reform, can calmly estimate how it may be. In Germany, he is charged with being the cause of the empire's collapse, and a very considerable literature has sprung up, bearing with it a mass of circumstantial evidence that gives the thinker pause. In England, he, the Jew, is charged with being the real world ruler, who rules as a super nation over the nation, rules by the power of gold, and who plays nation against nation for his own purposes, remaining himself discreetly in the background. Okay, now, that I thought that was interesting because, first of all, he brings up the idea of the Jewish origin of Bolshevism, mm-hmm. which I think now is basically, you know, I have the what I think is the accurate list of, you know, the Politburos and the different authority structures in after the Soviet was established in 1919. And it's 95% Jewish.
Yeah, not every Bolshevik was a Jew, but it was a Jewish operation.
It was a Jewish operation. They had a few that weren't. Like, for example, Lenin may not have been. He was presented as not being Jewish.
But he was sent in by a Jewish banker.
He was sent in by these guys, and his real ethnic background is not particularly clear. No one really knows who he was. He's mm-hmm. a question mark. Certainly wasn't a Christian. But in any case, all around him in the Politburo were Jews. I mean, it's just I don't think that you can really dispute this. And the idea that that this group then was responsible for tens of millions of Gentiles' deaths is, again, a historical fact. Then in Germany, you know, that's an area that is more complicated. The relationship to the German collapse in World War One to Jewish influence. I know this case is made often. I personally am not aware of strong evidence to support it, but nevertheless, it certainly is. Ford brings it up. But of course, in England, you know, when he talks about being a world ruler who plays nation against nation, the power of gold. I mean, you're obviously talking about the English banking families. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've done shows on how that class, the British Freemason in combination with English Jewish banking families, then were able to create Zionism and then the Nazi Party. So when you talk about playing nation against nation, I mean, I think that's my analysis is that's exactly right. So that was what Ford wrote. Now, I think in our current and then finally, it's just that. So he says, in America, it is pointed out to what extent the elder Jews of wealth and the younger Jews of ambition swarm through the war organizations, principally those departments which dwelt with the commercial and industrial business of war, and also the extent to which they have clung to the advantage which their experience as agents of the government gave them. So that's pretty, you know, intensely critical. It was written in 1920. And then the response was, which was quite interesting, is the ADL just, you know, went right after him. And so what they did was they brought about a group of Christians to attack Ford. You know, this was organized by Jews, but the public, the American Gentile world, they didn't understand that in back of the attack on Ford was the ADL. They were responsible for a whole series of pamphlets, one of which was called The Poison Pen, which, you know, kind of went after Ford as simply being racially motivated and nothing. But moreover, their more effective ones were things like they organized what was called the Federal Council of Churches, which is an ecumenical Protestant organization comprised of 32 different Christian sub-denominations. Now, these were all, this group was completely organized by the ADL. So you can see how the ADL was operating so effectively in terms of propaganda, because they had come forward as Jews and said, look, you know, we don't like being criticized like that. There would have been a different response, but instead they went and funded and then created this Federal Council of Churches, which then They then had basically a whole series of papers and articles, and the signees were notable in all of these things in that they were all Gentiles. You see. So they not only organized this organization, but then they organized stories. And it has turned out that this was all being orchestrated through the ADL, but the image that was presented then to the European, background public was that, well, these are just Christians coming forward against something that's un-American.
Yeah, and just to acknowledge that there's Jewish agency and organization, and they themselves acknowledge the fact they are sort of a rootless cosmopolitan, the diaspora. They go throughout the world, and yet they're all connected, you know, back to Israel. And so that it creates this very relationship, this sort of ambiguous relationship they have to the host country. And then they organize on that principle. Then when you point out that this organizing principle, how they operate, they come down on you like a ton of bricks. Yet the fact that the ton of bricks is coming down on you proves their existence.
Right.
They do it because who's throwing the bricks at you? And the fact that they can, through their financial muscle, pay goy or Christian frontmen to do their work for them, so as proxies, and it's very easy to do that. And you can either do it through bribery or through mind control because of the propaganda. A similar experience occurred during Vatican II, when Malachi Martin, it's been said, was an agent of B'nai B'rith and the American Jewish Committee to change the church's teachings on the relationship to the Jews, and particularly their relationship, to the crucifixion, the Christ. And they issued Nostra Aetate. They didn't get that, but nevertheless, because of the control of the media, they control the interpretation of it. And since then, the church has been neutered. In fact, the church now says that it has no special mission to evangelize the Jews, because that would be genocide, according to Abe Foxman. Now, regardless of what you think about with any religion should seek to want to evangelize if it claims to be a religion. But now it's stating that they don't want to evangelize Jews for fear of being called anti-Semitic, which is just absurd. But this was this infiltration that occurred through the interpretation of this document that came out of Vatican II through groups like the American Jewish Committee and B'nai B'rith. And they rewarded Martin with very lucrative book contracts for his efforts. You've mentioned before this issue of cryptos and who is and who isn't and these things. And I think it was Hilaire Belloc who wrote in the early, he's now written off as an anti-Semitic, but he was very considered a very serious thinker in his day in the early 20th century. He wrote a book called The Jews, The Jewish Question. And this is back when this was talked soberly and responsibly that there was a problem of the relationship between Jews and their host societies and how they act, and much of the anti-Semitism or negative behavior attitude towards Jews was a result of Jewish behavior. And that in itself was an acknowledgement of reality, which could be the basis for a constructive dialogue as opposed to being to the host society being constantly lectured at how evil they are, from Jewish organizations. But he wrote about how in the 19th century, the high rate of intermarriage between Jewish families and the British aristocracy. And by the 20th century, he said all important aristocratic families in Great Britain had intermingled with Jewish families. And this became the basis for the financial power in England. Of course, we the Rothschilds had taken over the British crown more or less, by the late 19th century. Britannia ruled their ways, but Rothschild ruled the British state through finance. And that's, we get into this whole, thing about what's the difference, the whole idea of British philo-Semitism and the role of British Freemasonry and Judaism and the New World Order. And it's always a going back and forth of which is the junior and partner in this thing. But it turns out that that there's a consanguinity now involved here that I think that explains a lot of the activities or intrigues of the past 100 years.
Absolutely, and that's a great area of research is the inbreeding between the British aristocracy and Jews that took place in the 18th and 19th century. I've read a number of British aristocrats of European descent who were warning that, he said that, and this one person was saying that the Jews basically seemed to be breeding the British aristocracy out of existence. And he said that, he noted that, you know, that even the people that were presenting themselves as having European background, he said he was worried that some of them might be cryptos. He actually brought up this, I wish I forget recall his name, but he was a British aristocrat. This was in the 18th century. And he said that he wasn't really sure about some of these individuals, and that if you added them to the mix, he said there really wasn't any British, you know, background aristocracies left virtually. And this was, you know, 200-300 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so then when you look at like the Churchill family,
yeah,
or the Huxleys, you have to wonder, well, you know, the Churchills were part of this proto-Zionism. What motivates that? What would motivate someone, you know, like Palmerston to, you know, in 1842 to say now's the time to return to the homeland? It just seems so tangential to anything, you know, an Anglican oligarch would be interested in. But it wouldn't be the case if Freemasonry was hiding the secret of, you know, this kind of crypto background to its leaders. And I would point out that this isn't really a very far-fetched idea, because the problem of, you know, the converso or Marrano are the, you know, basically the individuals who were converted from Jews, from Jewish faith to Christians, who secretly retained their Jewish identity, right? That this was basically an issue throughout Europe for hundreds of years.
Yeah, particularly Spain, yeah.
Yeah, well, but also, I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, I have a book on Shakespeare, and I talk about the idea that Shakespeare was actually crypto-Jewish literature. In fact, and this would have been around 1600, you know, the Jews had been kicked out of England. It was one of the hundreds of nations they were invited to leave.
Yeah, they were in the 13th century,
yeah, 12th century, and then it turned out that there was a whole culture of crypto Jews in existence in Britain, and this was, you know, completely documented, because Emilio Bassano, who was basically, you know, was a Marrano, her background was Jewish, so she had converted to Christianity, that two of her cousins, who had been living there for some time, they were caught basically practicing Judaism in a secret synagogue. So in other words, there were secret synagogues in London in, you know, in the late 15th century, you know, I mean, well, 1590, the 16th century. And so, you know, that's that. Then the question is, well, what becomes of these individuals? Because remember, they're as they are hidden, they would be extremely well organized, right? And of course, what would be the goal if not political power? I mean, they're trying to basically find a place for themselves in Christian Europe, and so it's just unimaginable to me that their very every day, you know, wouldn't have been focused on, well, how do we get closer to the crown? And in Bassano's case, there is a document where her father and uncle were basically arrested by police, and they told the police, they go, you better treat us nice because we have better friends in the court than you do. That was like in 1570. So, later now, 1580, I think, 1585. So the thing is that the, you know, the question of the hidden Jewish influence, you know, hidden because it doesn't present itself as Jewish, presents itself as Christian or European, and then enables that force to be hidden. And so then the European can't really respond to it because it doesn't understand. You know, I mean, if you get, you know, you don't have to go into real complicated theories about nation versus nation, like just Bezos. Just imagine that the British aristocracy are all Jews, and then imagine that they among themselves have one view, and the people that are underneath them, what would be their relationship to them? Well, they would see them as, you know, animals, or just, you know, someone to, and so that hidden relationship would make the people, the subjects of the aristocracy, not understand the motivation, right, of wars, of the financial system. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
They wouldn't be able to really have a real understanding of reality, because they would be a kind of interference to just recognizing that they had been conquered by another people that were using the political system as a way to genocide. And of course, you know, then you have to wonder, well, what about the ADL? I mean, what role is it playing in this whole, you know, process if such a thing's going on?
Well, now, yeah, Jewish or Israeli influence in the U.S. elections is now just a foregone conclusion. In fact, people just accept it as normal. And we have to worry about, you know, Russian influence in the elections. And, of course, a lot of what we call Russian, the Russian crimes, the oligarchs are largely Jewish. They're not really Russian. I mean, Jackson Vanik Amendment 1974, I think, made that distinction where specifically Jews were allowed to emigrate from Russia. You know, this sort of agreement. And that sparked a whole other reason for Israeli espionage against the United States, serving those interests. And, you know, Pollack affair, or Pollard, rather, the Pollard affair.
Yeah, he was arrested, yeah.
Of these things. And so, yeah, again, another example of that, where that distinction, there are Russians when they want to hide behind the Russian label, but then they want to be, when it serves their interest, they'll be distinguished as Jews and be given special treatment. And
yeah,
the oligarchic criminal element in Russia is largely Jewish, who then also, if you look at it, also doing the bidding of Western finance, which again, arguably, is that a crypto Jewish operation? Yeah. I think ethically, it's obviously usurious.
Yes.
So nevertheless, it's internalized the ethics of Jewish finance. So
it has indeed. Yeah, so. And one of the things that I was looking through this, I was going, you know, what do you do about it? You know, how does Gentile people organize themselves against this? And I was thinking, you know, what we really need is like a anti-Gentile defamation league to basically, you know, be hysterical anytime someone says anything bad about, you know, the sort of Gentile background there, without an equal kind of propaganda force.
Yeah, well, there's the GDL, I think, the Goya.
Is there? Yeah, I mean, it can't be too powerful.
It isn't well funded.
yeah, that would be, yeah, like where is the money going to come from? But see, this is the thing, is that without that, then there's always going to be this issue of, they can, you know, through just financial power, they can just create much more, you know, media activity. And so then...
Well, they create the psychological warfare, mind control, the pornography, the sex, the music, and these things. That's, you know, so to beguile and, you know, and
yeah, they can do
the public.
Yeah, what they did to Ford.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, and look at Ford, who's, you know, who's this captain of industry, and, you know, imagine you know what they can do to a smaller fry, you know, and if you the excerpt you read from Ford is, it's a reasonable, sober analysis of the situation. Anyone who knows what's really going on in the world and how, you know, Jewish power organizes, it is a reality. I mean, come on. I mean, I'm sorry, Israel wasn't created, you know, by an act of nature. Or even an act of God, really. It was created by Jewish agency and organizations. Human action was involved in that, and that took a lot of organizing in these things. So
yeah,
it exists. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it just didn't happen.
Yeah, of course. You know, and looking at Ford's statement, I mean, I would say it's kind of like, this is almost sort of like a dividing line of consciousness. I mean, if anyone thinks that this analysis and this questioning is there's anything wrong with it, then basically I think you had have succumbed to the mind control and the propaganda.
Yeah, but Jews will admit that they do everything Ford said. Jews will admit to doing.
You know, of course, it's, you know, but they're proud of it. But the fact is that I think if this statement was read in public schools, that a lot of people would say, well, he's an anti-Semite.
Yeah, yeah, because it sounds
even though the questions spring right from, you know, the history of the time. And obviously,
I mean, AIPAC more or less makes every congressman sign a loyalty oath.
Yeah. Right.
So, right. I mean, it's like, okay. I mean, so how does, you know, from where do they derive their power? You know,
yes.
You know, so they have agency.
Yeah. So the Ford statement is, I think, you know, it's kind of useful because it's clear minded. It's, you know, measured. It's, you know, he seems to make a legitimate attempt to see both sides of the question, but he's asking real questions. And so, you know, Gentiles today should actually go back to Ford's statement.
Yeah, these were questions that we were allowed to ask before the Second World War.
Yeah, and my point is the questions are still on the table.
Yes. More so, I think, because if you a good example is the ADL goes to war against deniers and revisionists, as if nothing in history needs to be revised, reconsidered, or reanalyzed, or a different narrative entertained in these things. What are they saying? They're going to suppress sober historical analysis in favor of a historical narrative, which they create and promote based on what they think should be promoted. And they're admitting it. I mean.
Yeah.
You know, all the propaganda, all the lies, and all the lies that have been exposed about certain elements of the Holocaust. You know, like the book Night being a bunch of BS and these things. Elie Wiesel's book and these things. And
Anne Frank's diary.
Frank's diary and these things. And, you know, the whole, you know, even, you know, like the Holocaust industry, the book written, it talked about, it's a big money scam and these things. And like I said, there's no Jewish agency, then where is Germany sending that the reparations money to then? Who's cashing the check?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. And it isn't, by the way, it isn't like individual Jews, Jewish organizations then use that money to expand their power, to create, to reinforce the narrative again, so they can go back and to this day demand reparation payments from places like Germany and more or less extort the entire West, because the United States pays billions and billions of dollars in aid to Israel every year, not to mention you know, what we do with running up the debt and who's the primary beneficiary of that.
Yeah, of course. So, Tim, I've often complained about my lack of a social life because of my being a political extremist. And so to make myself more popular, I've changed my title. And now whenever people ask me what I do, I don't talk about books or anything like that. I say, I'm a historical revisionist.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I know. I just say, no, that's what I am. Yeah, I'm a historical revisionist. And I would hope that people who listen, you know, to our show would take that to heart. Is that, you know, when you are in social gatherings, declare yourself as a historical revisionist.
Yeah.
You know, man. I mean, this is what we are. This is what we have to do. Mm-hmm. History is just a system of propaganda. It's crushing us. It's making us, you know, incapable of defending ourselves. We all have to become historical revisionists.
Yep. There's one incident, actually, which kind of exposes the ADL for what it is, I think. In 1979, a guy named James Gutman applied to the U.S. Park Service to have a rally in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, of Nazis and American Nazi Party and KKK. And it turns out that Mr. Gutman was actually a Mordecai Levy, a member of the Jewish Defense League. And he was working with members of the ADL.
Sure.
More or less funded by them. through back channels. So here we have a member of the Jewish Defense League tied to the Anti-Defamation League applying for a permit for a rally for an American Nazi Party KKK rally in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Now, why are they doing that? Well, because they're trying to stir up a problem. They're going to create a problem, and then they're going to say, look, Nazis are going to get you. You better send us money. This is a real problem, but the problem now exists, and not for the ADL working with the JDL to hold the rally in the first place. So it was this Nazi rally was a JDL ADL front operation. It was a false flag, and so this goes. I mean, this is very similar to, you can look at this situation. You can look at the the FBI's crackdown on terrorist organizations when they crack these cases, and of course it was exposed in Trevor Aronson's book The Terror Factory, how all these terror groups are just FBI cutouts or creations that are there. They're funded by agent provocateurs to go in and bribe a few marginal gullible people to devise some sort of crackpot plan, and they crack the case, and then they reap the rewards in the press for saving the country from terrorism. So the whole war on terror, that aspect of the war on terror is fake. Of course, then you can take a broader picture, look at the whole wider global war on terror and these things, and all these terrorist groups, Al Qaeda, ISIS, they're funded by NATO, Anglo American Zio Empire, to stir up this problem, to create the perception that there is indeed evil terrorists out there going to get us, if not for NATO, if not for the Pentagon, if not for the FBI, if not for CIA, if not for Mossad and these things. So it's a whole thing is a big scam.
Yeah.
Not to mention that the long history of Israel's involvement in false flags attack, and of course you can extrapolate from that is if ADL and B'nai B'rith, which is a function of this or a branch of Jewish power, then. All these little, whether it's a bombing in front of a Jewish community center, hate campaign, swastikas on college campuses. These are usually end up being fake events. You mean like someone paints a swastika on a college campus, inevitably you find out it's some Jewish student trying to raise consciousness. fake.
But that really, underlines the impotence of the European, because the one is like Ford's statement where he talks about the supranationality, mm-hmm. where Jews can operate internationally because they are an organization, right?
Yes.
For better or worse, they are an organization. And it is a brotherhood, so that what happens in Israel is related to things going on in Britain.
Abe Foxman goes, my concern is Israel. I'm talking about the Armenian genocide, which, by the way, if you look at the research of that...
I know.
Well, the Jews in Turkey.
The Masons, yeah. Yeah. So it's
very that's
an ugly, an ugly statement.
Yeah.
But an ugly statement by Foxman, but I mean, so the guy is so wicked that it's like you don't even need to pile on anything else.
He's admitting he's an American. By the way, he was in Poland, and it was a Catholic family that adopted him to save him from the Nazis, and they baptized him a Catholic. And after the war, the Jewish family came back and claimed him. So he's still a baptized Catholic. But anyway, he's an American citizen.
Maybe he could become a cardinal.
Yeah. yeah, he could become a cardinal. Yes, right. Yeah. Wouldn't be much of a difference in many cases. But anyway, he's an American citizen now, but he's claiming his primary concern is Israel, a foreign country. Right?
Yeah, but just see, if they operate, nefariously, the Jews as a supranationality, kind of group, then think about how difficult it is for the European language groups to operate, against that. Even just in terms of legitimate financial, economic competition, I mean, what can they do?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we have, I mean, Tim, I don't have any international kind of Gentile organization that I can plug into and help me find a business opportunity for my widgets, in some other country.
Yeah, or operate on a different ethical plane so you get the competitive advantage.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so you see that...
Good example is usury, where Christians didn't do this, and they gave them an edge financially because Jews did. So there was a case with Jewish emancipation in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars. And everyone became citizens under Napoleon's reign, and he destroyed the Holy Roman Empire. But within the Holy Roman Empire, Jews operated in certain restrictions. They weren't citizens; they were considered alien populations. And there were certain restrictions which protected them from, I guess, some of the activities of the Jews. But then when Napoleon came in and emancipated, and good, it's done in terms of emancipation, this is a great thing, they immediately started complaining about the Jewish merchants who had access to cheap British goods were coming in and importing those goods and destroying local economies. And this created anti-Semitism, what was called anti-Semitism and hate. And Napoleon immediately started getting complaints about their practices. And this is the problem, is that in the moment these restrictions are removed, They don't adjust to the ethics and norms of their general society. They revert, or they maintain their unethical practices, and this creates a problem in the local economies.
Yeah, and then just going back to Ford, I mean, it's clear from Ford's statement to today, things have gotten worse. The mind control is much worse. All of the things that Ford was talking about are, obviously, have either been documented or situations that are much more dangerous to Europeans than they were when Ford was worried about it. So you can see that it's gone in a bad direction for Europeans, right? And my question is like, well, like the frog being boiled, when and how bad does it have to get before Europeans realize that, however you want to characterize the organization that controls Jewish financial and media power, it doesn't look like it's stopping, no. Right? It isn't. Where is it heading? Where is it going, Tim? I mean, isn't it clear it's going to world domination, world dictatorship?
Yeah, it's that's.
What else could be its goal at this point? I mean, it has everything else. So the fact that you see this momentum, culture moving, culture. In fact, it's worse now. All of these elements are worse now than ever before. Cultural Marxism, political correctness, all of these elements of propaganda, which are all coming from these organizations that are linked back into Masonry and Judaism. These things are becoming far more powerful with every day. Whereas if you think about European nationalism, European ethnic awareness, European financial power, it's all disappearing. So, I mean, to me, the structure of a war is visible, and there is just almost a rout. One side doesn't even know that it needs to fight back. So, I hope that the information that we bring out in the shows and in
well,
this
all
show,
they need to fight back. All they need to fight back is consciousness.
Yeah,
because that's right. Once you break the mind control. And what if we're not going to imbibe your the toxic media anymore? We're not going to live by the rules of the sexual revolution anymore. We're going to revert to more traditional roles and values, and so we'll have the communities, and we'll have we'll be psychologically healthy in these things. We'll have larger families and communities in these things. Well, then they won't have any power anymore. Is trying to create that consciousness,
I mean, we won't let you break up our family and ethnicity with weaponized feminism and weaponized integration.
Yeah. I mean, what if there's a general strike held, among women, this is sort of right consciousness saying, well, we're not going to be wage slaves anymore. We want to get married and have husbands that support us. Yeah. What would that do to the labor market?
And we don't want to be force-fed integration with propaganda TV, which gives the idea of an illusionary culture that doesn't exist for the idea of creating the culture. Mm-hmm. We want a media that reflects our culture and our ethnic backgrounds, which we are proud of and have produced us. So naturally, we want to continue with them. So, this is the future, hopefully, is that, break the intimidation, talk about these things, bring the information to people that don't have it, and all become historical revisionists.
Yeah. Every one of a revisionist.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And you don't, of course, that's why they're trying to shut debate down or even discussion about these
of course,
things. Because they can't withstand the scrutiny of a debate.
just like what they did to Ford. They didn't come forward and say, let's go through these issues. Right. They branded him as an anti-Semite and then used propaganda with the media to create the impression that religious people were opposed to Ford.
Yeah, and that was the same thing they did in the 50s, late 40s and 50s with dynamic silence, where anyone who was critical of, say, what was going on in Palestine at the time, they immediately found themselves, you know, without a platform. They'd lose their column. They'd lose their radio show, and they lose their shows would lose sponsorship in these things. This was being conducted behind the scenes to shut it down.
And yep. So
the idea was to avoid a debate.
Yeah, that's right. And so we're going to have the debate.
Yeah.
And we're not going to be shut up, and we're going to bring the information, about what's going on to the public, and we're going to basically just ram it down their throats.
Yeah, and just look up Dorothy Thompson.
The whole way that she was outed from her career because she asked questions. Well, there it is, you know. But we have to just, you know, learn to fight back. And the way you fight back is just don't get shut up and just keep demanding that these questions get asked, you know. Every time that they try to ram a false history down our throat or a false feminist perspective down our throat, just keep pointing out that, wait a second, these aren't sincere people in front of you. I mean, they could be sincere, but they are derived from a weaponized anthropology, a weaponized psychology, and that's really what you have to look at them as, is these are cultural weapons to destroy you. And we just have to keep, you know, pointing that out to people. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, Joe.
All right, Sam. Well, it was a lot of fun, and we will get them next week, buddy.
Okay, enjoy your weekend.
Have a great weekend. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you.